TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Europe's surge to the right and the expansion of NATO. With Yanis Varoufakis, Max Blumenthal, and Aaron Maté. Geeta Fahri interviews Yanis Varoufakis about the new wave of nationalism sweeping across Europe. Fahri is a Lebanese-British journalist. She was a lead anchor for the global news channel Al Jazeera English at its launch in Washington, D.C. She now works with TRT World, that's a Turkish public broadcaster in English, 24 hours a day.
A new wave of nationalism sweeping across Europe after far-right parties dominated recent European Parliament elections.
We live in a postmodern 1930s with a postmodern version of fascism.
Is the European Union turning away from its founding principles?
The idea of the European Union as a peace project was an excellent idea. My criticism is that of a Europeanist who looks at this European Union as a clear and present danger to democracy in Europe.
Hello, I'm Geeta Fahri. Welcome to Bigger Than Five. On today's program, we explore the shifting political landscape of Europe, where the rise of right-wing parties in the recent European Parliament election signaled a resurgence of nationalism across the continent. From Austria to France, from Germany to Italy, far-right parties have made significant gains, shaking up the political scene across the EU. In France, the far-right National Rally dealt a stunning blow to President Emmanuel Macron's party. In Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz called the rise of the extreme-right Alternative for Germany a decisive turning point. In a few moments, I'll be speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, whose radical left party, Mera 25, suffered a devastating loss, securing no seats in the European Parliament. So are we seeing the slow disappearance of leftist and socialist parties across Europe? Joining me now to discuss the key factors behind the resounding electoral defeat of his and other European anti-establishment parties is Yanis Varoufakis, a former Greek finance minister and economics professor. Yanis Varoufakis, the move towards the far right in many of the EU's 27 member states has shocked many people inside Europe and across the world. What do these results tell us about where Europe stands today and where it's headed?
What it says is that we are experiencing a postmodern version of the 1930s. For exactly the same reason. If you think about 2008, the great financial collapse beginning in Wall Street and then toppling the French and the German banks, this is our generation's 1929, in exactly the same that Wall Street collapsed, 1929, 2008. That was followed by a policy of harsh austerity upon the majority of people with state intervention in favor of an oligarchy, a very, very small proportion of the population, primarily the financial sector. That created a combination of a lot of money in the financial system produced by the European Central Bank, Bank of England, and so on. So lots of money in the banks, but not enough money in the people's pockets.
But so does it mean that the rise of some of these parties on the right and the far right, is it a reflection of the failures of leftist socialist parties, or is there something else at play?
The left failed to put forward coherent, rational plan for reversing austerity for the many and socialism for the very few. And the result was that this discontent, anger, the sense that most people have in Europe, that their children are going to have a worse life than they have. Yeah? If you take the anger that generates and you have the complete fragmentation of politics, all you need to throw into this mix is a right-wing, racist, xenophobic populist standing on a soapbox and saying, give me all the power and I will make you great again. I will look after you. I will turn against the Muslim, the Jew, the Greek, doesn't matter, the other, someone that becomes the figure of hatred and somebody who magnetizes all this discontent.
But are we seeing a repeat, though, of the 1930s? Would you go as far as to suggest that we are drifting towards fascism? Because you did make similar statements recently saying hate is the fuel of fascism. So if you blend discontent and you throw in the hatred that is reinforced by the algorithms, that's fascism.
Indeed, this is precisely the point I'm making, that we live in a postmodern 1930s with a postmodern version of fascism. Look, history rhymes. It creates versions of its past. It never repeats itself identically. But now we have a version of fascism for the first time. We had the business community in France embracing the ultra-right party of Marine Le Pen for the first time. That was a big difference between the 1930s and today. In the 1930s, industrialists, especially in Germany, effectively embraced Hitler. They embraced Mussolini in Italy. That had not happened yet. We see this in Germany. Slowly and steadily behind the scenes, industrial capital is embracing, and financial capital, bankers are embracing the extreme right within the Christian Democrats, within the Alternative for Deutschland.
But isn't this part of what politics is all about, trying to find compromises and workable, practical solutions? Because what is the alternative?
How about humanism? How about a rational approach to the problems? Because you see, the problem with fascism is that they're not interested in compromise. They want to lull us into a false sense of normality, that they have become normalized, before they weaponize the security systems and weaponize certain militias that they are already working. Look at what's happening in the suburbs of Paris. Already, right-wing, anti-Muslim, anti-migrant militias are working with the police in order to create a climate of fear. So if you are the son or the daughter of an Algerian family or a Moroccan family in the banlieues of Paris, this is not just another election which is happening now. It is the beginning of a nightmare.
But what does it say about the electorate across Europe, that parties that espouse these kinds of extreme anti-immigration policies are on the rise? And we are seeing, aren't we, the slow disappearance of the left, of socialist parties.
Well, you're talking to one of the major losers of the last European Union election. I'm talking about myself. We were decimated. And for the last year, our party, Mera 25, has been defeated here in Greece, in Germany, in Italy. Our colleagues in Ireland have been defeated.
What is the key reason? Why, do you think?
Well, the key reason is our collective failure as the left, which I take partly responsibility for, because in 2015, when our government here, when the government I was party of, party two, in 2015 were elected, we managed to go from 4% of the electorate to something like 60% support in the space of 2 years. And we blew it. We betrayed the people. We essentially delivered them into the clasps of the financial sector, into the clasps of those who wanted to take their homes through repossessions, through evictions, those who increase the taxes for the working class, for the petty bourgeoisie, for the shopkeepers. And therefore, we're completely and utterly discarded as a possibility of change. And, you know, people like me have to be very harsh on ourselves. But you have to realize that in 2015, there was a wave of optimism regarding a progressive humanist agenda across Europe because we won government. And that died the moment our government surrendered. This is exactly what happened in the 1930s.
And you say the governments have surrendered to whom? External pressures? You've said the European Union has become subservient to US interests. Is that what you mean by surrendered?
Not exactly. That what you're saying is what happened eventually. But our government surrendered, not some kind of ethereal abstract force. No. Surrendered very, 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 very specifically to the International Monetary Fund. We have the institutions of the European Union, but essentially, when it comes to geopolitics, when it comes to investment, when it comes to politics, when it comes to ethics, we are our master's voice. And our master is Washington, D.C. Look at the preposterous behavior of Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, who dared, without any authority, any legitimacy, any approval by the European Parliament, not even by her own commission, to stand in front of the IDF's tanks in Israel a few hours before the IDF stormed into Gaza to kill tens of thousands of children. And she acted like the cheerleader of the Israeli force of occupation on behalf of Europe, without any European having authorized her to do that. That's why I'm saying this is not a European Union.
And you've been very critical, consistently, of the European Union. You've called it nasty, brutish, stupid, irrelevant. You've also said that it has not just fallen behind ethically, geostrategically, economically, that the EU rulers, as you call them, are hell-bent on war and naked exploitation, saying that what was once a peace project has now morphed into something sinister. Has the EU become the war union, as you suggest?
The idea of a European Union as a peace project was an excellent idea. I supported it all my life. So my criticism is that of a Europeanist who looks at this European Union as a clear and present danger to democracy in Europe, to the future of Europe. And you're right, we have become a war union.
But let me ask you this about the militaristic policy that you say is taking over the European Union. Do you believe that it is the result of the shifting dynamics from within, capitalism and what you have suggested, the military-industrial complex and its investment in the arms industry, or is it the pressures from outside, the United States dictating to many of the Western countries its policies when it comes to Ukraine and other conflicts?
Well, all that is important, but I think the root cause is different. It's got to do with a terrible construction of the common currency called the euro. The moment we created the euro, we created centrifugal forces within Europe. You saw that in 2010, how Greece became bankrupt, then Ireland, then Portugal, then Spain, then Italy. You saw the harsh austerity that was in. These are centrifugal forces that are a result of the bad construction of the euro.
Given this reality and the current structures of the global financial, military, political structures, is there an alternative?
Not in the foreseeable future, but look, let me answer your question in the affirmative. There is always an alternative. It is the greatest fallacy to think that there is no alternative.
You have accused NATO of having, quote, a mafia-driven strategy of turbocharging people's insecurities to sell them protection. But given what most European governments feel about the Russian threat, could you foresee the end of NATO, or is NATO essential to maintaining a certain sense of geopolitical stability in Europe?
The greatest enemy of stability and peace in Europe is NATO on the one hand and Putin on the other. They are symbiotic with one another. NATO has produced, well, particularly, not so much NATO, but the United States have produced Putin. Let's remember that after 1991, under Yeltsin, it was the United States government that intentionally pulverized the economy of Russia. They pulverized it. They went in there, all guns blazing, and destroyed the Russian economy and created huge amounts of poverty in Russia, thus creating the discontent, the anger, which allowed somebody like Putin to take over and become Putin. At the same time, through NATO expansion, they have been creating a very solid narrative in Russia, not just within the Putin regime, but every Russian, progressives and so on, they understand that having nuclear weapons, American-made nuclear weapons, right on their border is really not the best recipe for peace in our region. Now, the fact that, of course, NATO provoked Putin into doing what he did in Georgia, doing what he did in Ukraine, is not a justification for Putin. I have always chastised Putin as a war criminal.
Do you believe that the West is intent on prolonging this war against its own interests?
Absolutely. But you know, what is the West? The West is not the people of the West. The West is led by politicians who are directly in the pockets of the arms dealers, the fossil fuel industry, and various interests that are prepared to cut deals with the American military-industrial complex, which absolutely needs a war in Ukraine, a war in Gaza, and I'm afraid that they are in the process of engineering another one in the Pacific over Taiwan.
How do you see the extent of the hypocrisy when it comes to Ukraine and Gaza?
When Putin switches off the electricity in Mariupol, when he bombs hospitals, he's a war criminal for the West. When Israel does that to a much, much greater extent, then this is self-defense. This is the definition of toxic hypocrisy and indeed an idiotic process by which the West undermines its own claims to be interested in human rights and impartiality. But allow me to say that this is no time for politicking, for me making grand pronouncements. I can't sleep at night when there are kids that are injured without parents, searching in the rubble for something to eat, trying to bury their brothers and sisters. When we have this as a policy of the West, this is not an accident. This is not a situation that somehow went out of control. This is a policy by Israel. Israeli ministers and generals come out and say, our objective is the total annihilation of Gaza. They say it. It's not for me to accuse them of that. They admit it.
But how do you explain the silence?
Germany, the United States sent them 2,000-pound bombs to continue this massacre, this genocide.
Why should Palestine and what happens in Gaza matter so much?
One of my favorite German philosophers, Georg Hegel, once said that no people can be free if another people are in chains. This is a German philosopher, one of the foundational philosophers of the German humanist tradition. And I think he was right. We cannot be free until Palestine is free, until everyone is free. And at the moment, you know, if this was the 1930s or 1940s, you, me, we would all have a duty to concentrate on aiding our Jewish friends, our Jewish co-humans, who were suffering the Holocaust. Today, we have exactly the same way, whether they're, you know, Greeks, Turks, Germans, Muslims, atheists like I am. We have to stick together in order to effectively expunge our own guilt at what's happening in Gaza, in East Jerusalem, and in the West Bank. And let's not forget that a people who are essentially made to feel that it is normal for the state to participate in a genocide, to assist the genocide, they're digging their own grave, because their own, our own regimes, if we start feeling that it's okay, this is what happens, the next step is, you know, the fascists breaking down our door, the security system, you know, arresting us. Our own democracy is predicated on not accepting as normal a genocide of the sort which is unfolding as we speak in Gaza, in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank.
All right. Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
That was the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. He's an economist and acclaimed author. Since 2018, he has been Secretary General of DiEM25, the Democracy in Europe movement. That's a left-wing pan-European political party that he co-founded in 2016. He was interviewed by the Lebanese-British journalist Geeta Fakhri on TRT World. They spoke on July 12, 2024. This conversation was published on YouTube under the title Tipping Point, Europe's Surge to the Right. Next up, a segment from The Gray Zone on NATO. The Gray Zone is an independent news website producing original investigative journalism on politics and empire. Max Blumenthal is an American author and blogger. He was a writer for The Nation and Alternet and has written for The New York Times and The Los Angeles Times. Here's Max Blumenthal.
And it was a momentous summit for a lot of reasons. One, obviously, the Beltway chattering class all wanted to see how Biden would perform. Most of Biden's remarks there, seated with Jens Stoltenberg, NATO Secretary General, were scripted. He was handed sheets and basically told what to say. But then he had what Trump called his big boy press conference on the final day of the NATO summit, where Biden had to face the press kind of just alone, without teleprompters. What the Beltway press wasn't interested in was how NATO was laying the groundwork for a new Cold War and possibly a nuclear war. They, in their final declaration, accused China of enabling Russia and providing Russia with dual use goods, which can be used for civilian and military purposes, therefore allowing Russia to continue its war effort against Ukraine. So much of the declaration was directed against China, and NATO is seeking to bring Japan into its alliance, a country not very close to the North Atlantic, violating Japan's pacifist post-war constitution and transforming the society and the country further into a frontline base in the new Cold War with China. NATO also announced at this summit a liaison office, not anywhere again, anywhere near the North Atlantic, but in Amman, Jordan. And what's that about? Well, it's clearly about protecting Israel's strategic depth and countering Iran and the popular mobilization units, which actually stand up for Palestine, as we saw when Jordan was the base for U.S. Patriot missile batteries to parry Iran's ballistic missile launches. So NATO is shaping up to be not just an expansionist entity moving towards Russia's frontiers, but a global war alliance directed against any country that doesn't kowtow to the Washington consensus. And this is Biden's true legacy, which I think he actually spoke about, I wouldn't say articulately, but with full command of the facts during his big boy press conference. Aaron, I don't know if you have any thoughts overall about the NATO summit or just NATO's role in the world today.
Well, a hugely dangerous announcement was unveiled at the NATO gathering. It's just worth highlighting up top because no one's covered it. It's just got a collective yawn in the West, which is that the Biden administration and Germany jointly announced that the U.S. is going to deploy long-range missiles to Germany now. And these were missiles that were previously explicitly banned under the INF Treaty, which was a major Cold War arms control agreement reached in the 1980s after a global movement of people rose up against nuclear proliferation, which had eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons by the thousands. And Donald Trump, under the leadership of Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, withdrew from the INF Treaty in 2019. And that got a collective yawn inside the U.S. because at that time, that was the peak of Russiagate hysteria, where everybody was conditioned to believe that Trump was really doing Vladimir Putin's bidding and was working to serve Putin's interests because he was being blackmailed with sex tapes and other compromise. So everybody ignored that. And even when Russia proposed moratoriums on the development of those long-term missiles, the U.S. ignored it. And so finally, the U.S. and Germany saying, we're going to deploy missiles in Germany that were previously banned under this treaty. And no criticism at all from supposedly anti-war progressives in Congress because they're on board with this whole agenda. It's insanity. But things are so crazy right now that this kind of reckless behavior is so normalized, it doesn't even get a mention. I mean, try to look at progressive media, see who's covered it or even mentioned it. It's been ignored. So we'll talk more about that later, but I think that's worth stressing up at the top of the show.
Well, yeah. Zelensky was in town on that very point. Zelensky was in DC in one of his G.I. Joe Halloween costumes. Zelensky was there to actually push Biden for missiles that could strike deeper into Russia or for authorization to use U.S. attackums for strikes deeper into Russia. And it's unclear. I thought the U.S. had already authorized that. This is something Biden addressed in his press conferences. And his wife, Olena Zelenska, who's famous for her shopping trips, your U.S. tax dollars at work, was putting on the best face possible for this lobbying campaign. This is the New York Times. As Olena Zelenska, the First Lady of Ukraine, accompanies her husband to Washington for the NATO summit, her stylist discusses the role clothes play in the war effort. And here she is seated across from Turkish leader Recep Erdogan, dressed as a extra in The Handmaid's Tale. This is unusual. I don't know what role the clothes are playing there. It really highlights, I think, unwittingly, how disgusting Project Ukraine is, because you have this whole oligarch class that is insulated from the effects of the war. who have been able to evade the draft, while the rest are being used as basically Slavic manpower for the NATO project of weakening Russia at its soft underbelly. Actually, George Soros published an essay, I don't have it up in front of me, oversight on my part, going into NATO called the NATO and the New World Order, in which he said that Western publics are averse to losing their own soldiers and also to even participating in the military. Like, there's a recruitment crisis in the US. So the US and Europe, Western Europe, Brussels, can rely on what he called the manpower of Eastern Europe and provide the tech and the materiel while the Slavic masses die.
Here's that quote, Max, from George Soros. This is from years ago.
Thank you.
The combination of manpower from Eastern Europe with the technical capabilities of NATO reduced the risk of body bags for NATO countries, which is the main constraint on their willingness to act. So, as you say, George Soros's vision has come true. It's come true.
Yeah. It's just completely inadvertently.
Yeah.
It was all an accident that Uncle George's vision came true.
And, you know, just this display of the First Lady of Ukraine being scrutinized for her fashion style, and recall the previous Vogue magazine photo shoots and really weird photo shoots of, like, with models posing as Ukrainian victims. So yeah. Compare all that, that's like the celebration of wealth and of just of oligarchy that she represents with the plight of average Ukrainians. So obviously there's hundreds of thousands who've been killed, and all from the lower classes being sacrificed for this war. But then also you have, and we've covered this recently, Ukraine is selling off its state assets because they have no money, and the US and its allies, despite all their lofty pledges, aren't providing enough. So Ukraine, as has long been the vision of people like George Soros and other Western oligarchs, has now been forced to sell off its state assets to fund the war effort, in which they're being used as sacrificial lambs for the goal of bleeding Russia.
That was Aaron Matti. He's a Canadian journalist and producer and hosts Pushback on The Gray Zone. He received the Izzy Award for his coverage of Russiagate in The Nation magazine. Previously, he was a host and producer for The Real News and Democracy Now! Aaron Matti and Max Blumenthal spoke on July 13, 2024. You can find the unedited segment of this exchange on the YouTube channel of The Gray Zone under the title NATO Plans Global Conflict Expansion at DC Summit. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Our email address is TUC@TUCRadio.org. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.